laptop died, and so this is going to be a Blackboard talk. And that means that if you're terrified already of me going over, you should be over time, you should be even more terrified, but I'm going to try to make up for it by speaking extremely fast. So, obviously, I think we'll all remember where we were when we first heard this incredible news about the BICEP result. If it holds up, it'll be one of the really great scientific discoveries of all time. We're just amazingly lucky to be living in an era where this kind of thing happens. Thinking about large gravity waves modes, of course, has been something that's not a big shock. It's not a big surprise. The people who invented inflation 30 years ago thought about it. The natural scales they were thinking about 30 years ago were the gut scale. That's where it came from. The inflaton was the Higgs that broke a gut long, long ago, right? So we've been thinking about these things for a long time. And just personally, I spent very much motivated by thinking about the possibility of seeing large R, as well as the theoretical difficulties, or supposed theoretical difficulties in the air with the Lith bound and large field range and so on. I spent around 2 years, starting around 10 years ago, thinking a lot about this question. And so I came to a certain point of view about it, a certain attitude about it, where the summary was m squared phi squared looks great. Maybe Matthias and I are reinforcing each other. We've been telling each other m squared phi squared looks great for a long time. And I was actually very excited this year about finally seeing the gravity waves from Planck. And the biggest surprise and disappointment this year was that we didn't see them, and it didn't look like m squared phi squared. And so we still don't know if it's m squared phi squared, but it's definitely on the table again. And the thing which I think, regardless of whether something else is going on or not, it would be great to, and we will soon kill it. But anyway, I want to tell you why thinking about all these things in the large field range and all that, I came to that conclusion. One thing is, like everyone else, I've been digesting all this news and thinking about it and putting it together in my head again, or trying to. A few weeks is not long enough to have something really novel and interesting to say about it. But I'll say a few things about what I think, at least seems to me, to be some interesting new things to be doing with this information as well. All right, so first, a 3-minute summary of what we've actually learned if we interpret it, if we interpret the large gravity waves as coming from inflation. What we've learned is almost completely determined by a certain symmetry breaking pattern, okay? Especially from the point of view of the effective field theory of inflation, we just posit that there exists this background where the universe is inflating with the inflation rate slowly inflationary rate slowly decreasing, and that's it. There is a physical scalar field, which is there's the clock that controls that controls the background. The fluctuations of that is the physical scalar field, everything just follows from that assumption that you have approximate De Sitter space, just the change by the slow roll. As Matthias pointed out, we've actually learned a little bit more, because purely from the point of view of the effective theory of inflation, we could have had that the clock mode had a different speed of sound than light, and a very different speed of sound than light. What that would have corresponded to from the point of view of symmetries is that in the inflationary phase, we have an approximate scale symmetry, but not the relativistic generalization of that, which in flat space would be full Lorentz invariance, and in this background would be approximate De Sitter symmetry. Okay? So if the speed of the inflaton was very different than one, the background would have approximate scale symmetry, but not enjoy an enhanced approximate De Sitter symmetry. And since we see that the speed of sound is pretty close to one, then we're also concluding a little bit more, that that the early inflationary phase had an approximate De Sitter symmetry. Okay? Now, there's an analogy that, depending on your background, you may find useful, but I think it's an amusing analogy that's been made many times in the context of the effective theory of inflation. With inflation on the one hand, and the physics of massive W and Z particles on the other hand. Okay? In both cases, all the gross features of the physics are completely determined by a symmetry breaking pattern, and there are some Goldstone modes. The Goldstone modes are the longitudinal W's and Z's, in this case, longitudinal polarizations. Here it's the clock or the inflaton. In both cases, if you wrote down a random theory, you would have less symmetry than you could. Here, if we wrote down a big masses for the W and the Z that were very different from each other, we could perfectly well do that. But we discovered that the theory actually has an approximate, not exact, but an approximate global symmetry, an enhanced global symmetry, extra global symmetry. Here it was the custodial SU2 symmetry, and here it's an approximate de Sitter symmetry. And then, of course, people wanted to go on and find models that gave rise to these Goldstone particles, you know, a more complete theory from which they arose. And the very first set of things people did for electroweak symmetry breaking were the simplest possible theories, where the Goldstones survive as scalars in the high energy theory, survive as simple scalar fields in the high energy theory. Okay, so that's like the Higgs models or linear sigma models. Okay? And in this context, that's every model of inflation, concrete model that anyone had ever written down. Okay? So when we say that no matter what abracadabra was causing inflation, there would be a scalar field during inflation, the clock. But when we write down inflationary models, we assume that that scalar field is an elementary scalar that, for example, today, in our vacuum, in our universe today, we, by doing high energy physics experiments, we could produce that scalar field, right? So now, that's very simple. In this case, it was the simplest set of possibilities. It's the simplest set of possibilities here. But so long as you have this symmetry breaking pattern, everything is going to be the same, no matter how you get it. Okay? So this is a particular assumption we're making about what's going on. Now, for the case of electroweak symmetry breaking, people did look for theories with very different UV degrees of freedom, okay, where the Goldstones didn't look anything like scalar fields in the underlying theory. And here, you know, it was like Technicolor. One of the interesting things I think to think about is we don't know what the analog of that is for inflation. Okay? So we really could assume all we need is a theory that gives us, it needs a weak coupling, it needs to give us this background with the approximate de Sitter symmetry, and no matter where it comes from, we're going to reproduce all the predictions we have, all the gross predictions we have right now, but it's possible that there's something a lot more interesting going on. Now, of course, this didn't historically work out for electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay? But whether it does or doesn't work here is something, well, first we need to understand what these theories look like better, and then second, it'll be up to experiment to decide. All right, so that's the summary. But now, along these lines, I want to spend some time talking about large field inflation and the famous Transplanckian problem. And everyone who begins talking about the Transplanckian problem writes down something like this, higher dimension operators, and says that we're making a very, very big assumption about UV physics when we say that we can have delta phi much bigger than M Planck. And well, that's true, but this kind of effective action is far too naive. No decent four-dimensional effective field theorist would write this down. The reason is it's not even internally self-consistent. It's not internally self-consistent to say if the only scales in the problem are the Planck scale. It's not internally consistent to say that mass is tiny, but all these higher dimension operators are there at order one. If you just compute radiative corrections, you'll find that the mass goes up to the Planck scale. Okay? So you would never write this down anyway. Okay? So what you have in mind, obviously, is a situation where it's like a Goldstone boson. There's a scalar, there's a shift symmetry, phi goes to phi plus constant, that's weakly broken. And, you know, as you all know, the examples like natural inflation, okay, exactly the same kind of potentials we get in pion physics and so on, which can make it work. But there is a sense that something is going wrong when the field gets bigger than M Planck. What would actually physically go wrong if you had a field get much bigger than M Planck? What would be physically bad is if in the traversal of this field, some other degrees of freedom that you don't see anything wrong with the field itself, right? The field itself, we calculate loop corrections, we do everything we want, there's nothing wrong with the field itself. What would be bad is if in this big, many Planckian traversal, some other degrees of freedom that the particle is coupling to become incredibly massive, okay? Become very massive and head up to super Planckian masses. Then we'd be making assumptions about Planck scale physics. But what's going to save us from that is a weak coupling. And obviously, there has to be a weak coupling in the problem. Otherwise, if phi, so for example, if phi had a big coupling, here's a simple example. If phi had a big Yukawa coupling to some fermions, if I had a big Yukawa coupling, G phi psi psi to some fermions, if G was order one, then absolutely, we're making some big assumption about what's going on near the Planck scale. We're saying that this phi is getting 10 times heavier than M Planck. But exactly that would give an enormous contribution to the mass of phi. So G had better be weak. Okay? If G is weak, there isn't a problem. We get a radiative correction to the mass squared of phi that goes like G squared over 16 pi squared, some cutoff squared, might be the string scale, might be the Planck scale, some high energy scale. And in order for this not to, if G is small enough, these corrections are small, which makes it controllable to begin with. And it's exactly the same thing that is associated with the fact that these particles are not getting heavier than the Planck scale. Okay? That's a parametric statement. If you look at these one-loop corrections, the one-loop corrections are, let's say, a loop factor times, this is the mass squared of phi. That's what comes out of the Coleman-Weinberg potential, right? Times the UV cutoff squared plus so on and so forth, right? See, precisely what makes the one-loop potential small for self-consistently, for it to inflate, only works if these particles are not getting much heavier than the Planck scale. Yes?
Bottom-up argument would apply to, you know, all examples which have an approximate shift symmetry, including those that, you know, do have more structure than m squared phi squared.
I'll have a little bit more to say about this in I'll have a little more, yeah, I'll have a little more to say about that in a second. Yeah, in fact, yeah, just hold on. Okay. So that's fine. So we can imagine doing this. Actually, let me perhaps come to that point now. So we can imagine doing this non-supersymmetrically. We can imagine doing it supersymmetrically. If we do it supersymmetrically, the shift symmetry on phi, which is being weakly broken by that coupling, just tells us that the Kähler potential is some function of phi plus phi dagger, and we could have a superpotential that just has a mass term for phi. Okay, we could imagine that it couples phi couples to some heavy fields. And whether or not you get a potential, in this picture, whether or not you get a potential that goes like phi squared or some funny power of phi, has everything to do with the dynamics of the guys that it couples to. Okay, so if it looks like phi squared, it's because the things that it's coupling to are roughly free. Okay? But it could easily be another power. For instance, it's easy to do in the supersymmetric example. Imagine that these guys are actually NF flavors charged under an SUNC gauge theory. Well, we can work out the effective potential for phi after we integrate these guys out just by Gaugino condensation, and that gives us an effective potential, which is some constant phi to the NF over NC. So you can get, and in fact, there's a range. NF is bounded to be less than or equal to 3NC for this whole picture to make sense. So if it's equal to 3NC, you get phi to the 4 for the potential. If it's equal to 2NC, you get phi squared for the potential. If it's equal to 3 halves NC, which is the bottom of the conformal window, you get phi for the potential. Okay? But the power of phi has everything to do with the dynamics of the guys that are being made massive by the, right? No, this is one example. I entirely agree. I'm saying that the power for phi is reflecting something about the guys that are coupling to phi. That's right. No, absolutely. I'm just saying this is a simple example. Right. Okay. So from this point of view, what's wrong? Is there anything funny about a large field range? There is actually something funny about it. But it's exactly in the opposite place as you would expect. It's not because there are some particles that are becoming very massive, we can't control what's going on at the Planck scale. It's something different. Let's go back to this example. What's going What's funny is, so I have this field, this particle psi, right? The mass of psi is around g phi, so it's g times, let's say, 10 m Planck. Okay? Now remember, this is still a number that's much smaller than this Planck scale and the string scale because g is 10 to the minus 3. So here are some simple numbers, right? So let's say we have m Planck where it is. We have the string scale at 10 to the 17. Doesn't even matter. We have Hubble at 10 to the 14. We have the mass of the inflaton at the 10 to the 13 GeV. So all we need is for g to be 10 to the minus 3, not an insanely tiny number. Okay? And then everything is okay. But there is something funny here, which is, so there is an attractive force between these psi's that's mediated by phi. Right? The size of that force is g squared. Okay? But there's also a gravitational force between these guys. What's the gravitational force between them? Well, their mass is g times 10 m Planck, and it's over m Planck squared. So notice that the gravitational force is 100 times bigger than the scalar force. That's what's directly correlated. That's what's directly correlated with the large field range. Okay? You see, having a large field range is being accomplished by making a coupling physically give you a force or an interaction even weaker than gravity. So it's the other way around. Nothing is going on with heavy particles. Nothing is moving around. But I'm getting something, some interaction even lighter than gravity. So keep that in mind. So that's true in this example. But that I believe that's the crux of the matter. OK, what about the other thing that people often talk about as a problem here? Yes? No, phi is the inflaton. I'm saying that what we're learning is that the inflaton is mediating forces that are even weaker than gravity, 100 times weaker than gravity. Okay. Okay. So what about the other issue? Global symmetries. Here we're invoking global symmetries. Global symmetries are bad, illegal. We can't use them. Okay. All right, fine. If think global symmetries are bad or illegal, then we can realize exactly the same physics with a theory where we never talk about global symmetry. So imagine we now have, and imagine we have a five-dimensional theory. The radius of the circle is r. I can stabilize this circle from a five-dimensional field theory point of view trivially in 100 ways. Let me not talk about that. And it's not affected by any of the there's no back reaction effects in this case. It'll be obvious why in a second. And let's say I have a U1 gauge field in the bulk. Okay? No global symmetries. I just have gauge symmetries. Okay? So this is what we called way back then. By the way, this is a complete triviality. Okay? There's really nothing deep going on here. But it's just to push the point that the issue is not global symmetries or things like that, because we're going to now see all these things happen even when we just have gauge symmetries. So let's say I have a U1 gauge field in the bulk, and there's some massless or light charged matter in the bulk as well. Okay, so, and let's now, there's a light scalar field in the four-dimensional theory, which is the fifth component of the gauge field, or the Wilson line going around the circle. And so the effective action for that guy, the kinetic term starts off like that. And the angle, the actual Wilson line, is RA5. So I can rewrite this also as 1 over G5 squared R d theta squared. OK? Plus dot, dot, dot. OK, so now what is the plus dot, dot, dot here? Everything is a gauge symmetry now. There's no global symmetries anywhere. Now I have this, let's say, light or massless fermion. That light or massless fermion, in the low energy theory, has a Yukawa coupling to phi. Okay, and the size of that Yukawa coupling is just the four-dimensional gauge coupling, which is, you know, G5 squared over R. So that coupling there is G4. So this is exactly the picture that we were talking about before, right? It's a scalar with a small Yukawa coupling to a fermion. Now I can calculate the radiative correction to the potential for this guy. And now it's fully calculable. There is no unknown ultraviolet stuff, nothing. I just compute. The reason is that when I go to scales short compared to the the radius of the extra dimension. I see it's the fifth component of a gauge field. There's no potential coming from there. This is a super familiar thing from the physics of thinking about extra dimensions. This is a non-local object, the Wilson line wrapping around. So the potential is fully calculable. Okay? Now, there are unknown pieces. Sorry, the pieces that we don't know how to calculate would come from very massive particles, maybe near the Planck scale or the string scale. But they're exponentially suppressed by e to the negative mr of the circle. So long as the radius is 10 or 100 times bigger than the size of the circle, I can fully compute the potential for this guy. Okay? Furthermore, and it gives you exactly what we got before. So now, what does it take to have a super Planckian traversal? Well, here is the effective f squared, is this guy. The effective the four-dimensional Planck scale is m Planck squared is m5 cubed r. And therefore, f squared over m Planck squared is 1 over g5 squared m5 cubed. And I guess there is an r squared. Okay. So note that I can make this much larger than 1 so long as I make g5 squared m5 much smaller than 1. And of course, m5r should also be bigger than 1. So I need to make m5r bigger enough than like 10 or something in order for the exponentially small effects around the circle to be negligible. But no matter what I do, if I make the five-dimensional coupling weak enough, everything works. Completely calculable, okay, up to these exponentially tiny effects. So you see, it has nothing to do with global symmetries. And by the way, what's going on in this super Planckian traversal? Well, theta is just going from 0 to 2 pi. And this fermion that it's coupling to, the mass is just shifting up and down by order 1 over r. Everything is staying well within the purview of the effective field theory. So where's the trouble, if there is any? The trouble is that we have to make that five-dimensional coupling even weaker than gravity. So the issue is not something crazy going on in the ultraviolet. The issue is something that to an effective field theorist would seem like falling off a log. You're making the theory even more weakly coupled. Okay? You make the theory very weakly coupled, and you can do all of these things. So so then you say, if this is so easy to do, it must happen all the time in string theory. Or must be easy to do. I mean, if it's so easy, it must be easy. And yet, there was a lore that this was not easy to do. And it's easy to see why it doesn't seem easy to do. Well, there's a variety of things that you could blame it on in the beginning, which I think are actually technicalities and not really the point. But let me just say some of the practical things that happen, just if you try to do it in very simple ways. Is string theory is too unified, right? All the couplings are related to each other. So it's hard to make one coupling much weaker than the other. More technically, if you try to weaken couplings by compactifying on large volumes or things like that, everything, gravity goes everywhere. So gravity always gets diluted just as much as anything else. Then it's hard to make gauge couplings weaker than gravity. Then if you say, if you try to localize gauge fields on brains, it gets even worse because gravity is still going everywhere. Okay, so. So that's the sort of thing which makes it seem like it starts making it seem like it might be tough. Well, something that can occur to you is that something I can do, which I can do for gauge fields that I can't do for gravity, the graviton is unique. But I could have n U1s. Okay. Let's say I have n U1s, and I Higgs those n U1s down to the diagonal. If I take the Higgs the n U1s down to the diagonal, now it looks like you could win. Because now the diagonal coupling constant has an n in front of it, summing over all of them. But at least naively, at tree level, the n does not have to appear in front of gravity. So you say, aha, now I'm winning. I can have a big n. But then you think a little bit more again, without looking at detailed models, at least issues that would occur to you, is that if you're getting these n u1s from some compactification somewhere, wherever they are, they need room. You know, each one needs some string scale room. If you need a string scale room, then the size of the internal manifold should have an n in it. And then that would weaken gravity by a factor of n, exactly the same factor of n. That would be a tree level effect. Now, in fact, there's a one loop effect that you can't avoid, no matter what you do, which is that you have gravity here, and just four-dimensional gravity. And you have these n particles running around the loop. Those n particles renormalize the Planck scale. Okay? As some n times the UV cutoff of the theory squared, whatever that is. But now you see you're in trouble again. Because if you try to keep everything fixed and send n to infinity, then the n appears in both places, and you don't sort of parametrically win anymore. Okay? So these were the sort of games that that some of us were playing, and what it started looking like. But on the other hand, it's also clear there's no super direct relationship, apparently, between that n and these n's. So while you might not be able to win parametrically, not be able to get millions of e-foldings of inflation, you may well be able to win numerically. Okay? Then it becomes a detailed question. Now, all my friends who work on building models of inflation the past many years know that whenever they talk about one of their new models, the first question I ask them is, does it work parametrically? Okay? And at least so far, on all examples that I know of, everyone says, no, it doesn't work parametrically, but it can of course work enough to get you the 60 e-foldings that we want. That's, of course, perfectly fine. I don't care from the point of view of describing reality, I don't care whether or not it works parametrically. But it's a conceptual question of whether it's an actual, it's a mechanism which, when something works parametrically, you can go to an extreme limit and it's very easy to analyze what's going on. But if it's going to work when the numbers of order 10 or 100, then you've got to be very careful. In any specific example, you have to work very, very hard and actually check that all these corrections and everything is under control. Of course, our friends do that, but there's a conceptual difference between whether it's something numerical or something parametric. Okay, now, but these are all sort of technical reasons. And I want to give you what I think of, and actually thinking about exactly these questions, led to a couple of observations or conjectures, well, one observation and one conjecture about quantum gravity in general that is related to these things. So the first thing I want to quickly describe is what we called the weak gravity conjecture, which is now going back and saying, okay, why is it that I can't make a coupling arbitrarily weak? I mean, it seems like everything is great. So what goes wrong if I make a coupling arbitrarily weak? And well, something that should bother you is the thought that quantum gravity doesn't like global symmetries and should violate global symmetries. Imagine you had a global symmetry. Now imagine you took the global symmetry and you gauged it with a gauge coupling of 10 to the minus 100. Okay? Then it doesn't seem reasonable that it should all of a sudden go from being illegal to legit just by an immediate, minuscule gauging like that. Okay? So something should go wrong, even though it's surprising to the low energy effective field theorist. Something should go wrong as you try to make a coupling constant weaker and weaker and weaker. Something bad should happen in the low energy effective theory. And the weak gravity conjecture says that, in fact, what goes bad is that the low energy theory, so here's a loose form. And let me just to tell you where this is going, because I'm running out of time, but just to tell you where this is going, the claim is that there is a fact about gravity, the conjecture is that there's a fact about gravity, which explains, on the one hand, why it's not falling, like falling off a log to get these things to happen. Okay? And that's the idea that gravity should be the weakest force. Now, if you take that idea, there's two natural conjectures that you can make related to it. A strong form and a weak form. Okay? We tried very hard to make sense of the strong form. I'll describe it in a moment. And every strong form was violated. Okay? The only thing that we found lots of evidence for was a weaker form for it. The weaker form had the interesting feature that on the one hand it explained why it's not like falling off a log and you can't do it parametrically, but on the other hand suggested that it should be possible to do nonetheless, you know, sporadically. Okay? Yes. Yeah.
If we don't match to the, you know, the normalization of the power spectrum, once you match to that, then obviously you go off and you go to energy densities that go out of control, so it's not going to be parametric in that sense. But if you drop the scale, then you go longer and longer.
Well,
and
so
it is parametric, and it doesn't involve violation of the weak gravity conjecture. The theory doesn't give, it's consistent with the small f, without having a force weaker than gravity.
So
I'm just missing the, I guess, the logic or how.
Well, so.
You seem to conclude that it can't be parametric, and I didn't understand that statement.
No, I mean it can't be parametric. I mean it can't be parametric that if you try to keep everything else fixed, everything that if you keep all the couplings fixed, all the scales fixed, everything fixed, and then just try to make arbitrarily many e-foldings, it will fail.
Well, that's certainly true, but almost for a trivial reason, and that you'll get up to energy densities that are too high. I mean, that's how it fails in large field inflation.
No, sorry, but for example, in my four-dimensional effect, in this five-dimensional effective theory, it wouldn't fail. I could, if I made G5 arbitrarily tiny, I'll get arbitrarily many e-foldings. So that's what I'm talking about.
You would get up to eventually if your potential continued to increase. Maybe I didn't.
No, it doesn't increase. It's cosinusoidal. But if I drop G5 arbitrarily much, I get arbitrarily many e-foldings, leaving everything else fixed.
Leave it.
Yeah, it's a cosine with a longer and longer. Yeah, it's.
But then you're dropping the scale of inflation in effect, right? So I'm saying if you allow me.
Maybe we could talk about this. Offline.
If you go over a long range, over this, you know, much flatter potential, you're dropping the scale.
I'm saying that it's like. Can we chat about it right afterwards? Sorry. Yeah. So let's just say, just in this limited context, just even in this limited context, I'm trying to explain why I can't engineer that five-dimensional theory with arbitrarily weak couplings. Okay. So that's.
We can talk about what
it might mean more broadly. I suspect it's a much broader statement, but anyway. But that's something that I will try to say a tiny bit about. Anyway, let me just say what the loose form. So the loose form is that there should always be a particle whose mass is smaller than g times m Planck. Let's say if it was a four-dimensional statement, which means that there's always some particle such that gravity is the weakest force. So this actually typically implies that there's some UV cutoff in the theory that's smaller than g times m Planck. If you apply the statement to both electric and magnetically charged particles, you find something like this. And again, it's these loose forms which are what's loosely verified to happen in many very, very simple stringy examples. What could actual sharp statements be? The only sharp statement can be made for exactly stable particles. Okay? So what exactly stable particles could we have? We could talk about the lightest charged particle. But the lightest charged particle should satisfy this. And one reason why this should be true is if something like that isn't true, then it's hard to, then the theory would have an infinite number of exactly stable particles not protected by any symmetries. If we go to asymptotically huge masses, there's extremal black holes whose mass to charge ratio is 1. Okay? And then we'd have an infinite tower of particles. Of course, if it's supersymmetric, supersymmetry can guarantee that they're all stable. But without supersymmetry, there's no symmetries to guarantee that they're stable. And yet, if we don't have particles with a mass to charge ratio smaller than 1, it's impossible for extremal black holes to decay into them. Okay, so if you want extremal black holes to be able to decay into smaller objects, there had better exist some particles, something with mass to charge ratio smaller than 1. Then the question is that true of the lightest charged particle? Or is it just true of the particle whose mass to charge ratio is minimal? Okay, so this is a strong form. Both these particles are exactly stable. This is a weak form. And every way we try to make sense of this statement as it stands fails, many cousins of the statement fail. So we couldn't prove this statement. Or even we found counterexamples to that. But we didn't find any counterexamples to this statement. And in fact, it makes a number of non-trivial predictions, which, for example, makes predictions about the signs of various higher curvature operators and the effect of action that had better be there in order to decrease the mass-to-charge ratio of extremal black holes. And they're all true, quite non-trivially true. Okay? So what does this suggest? It says that there is a reason why I can't make couplings arbitrarily weak, but that in any given vacuum of the theory, in any given solution, there is some Q min, which is the charge for which M over Q is smallest and smaller than 1. Okay? Now, you would generically expect Q min to be of order 1, but it could be larger and larger and larger. In other words, the object to which these extremal things can decay can get heavier and heavier. They can start looking more and more like extremal, close to being extremal black holes. Okay? So if there's just a distribution of Q-mins, maybe you have to work a little harder to find Q-min of 10 or 100. Okay? And then, it's not working all that hard, then there isn't any problem. Okay? So that's the sense in which, in this case, numeric and not parametric. Okay. Now, let me just make two other comments, and then I will end. First, every mechanism that I know of to get large field involves a big N one way or the other. So we just talked about having n u1s to make the gauge coupling weaker. There's the n axions of n-flation. Those are the longitudinal modes of those n u1s that we talked about before. We can imagine we have two axions that are periodic in each direction, and the period is subplanckian, but for some reason, the potential is generated along a direction, which is n units in this direction and only one unit in that direction. So there's some funny charges, which are the ones that dominate. So we need to have some objects with n units of charge that are light enough to generate the potential that we want, but along this funny tilted direction. But in this tilted direction, we get a factor of n. There's, of course, the ideas that we've heard a lot about from Eva and her friends about brains wrapping circles and monodromy more generally, or their field theoretic cousins is UN gauge theories that again have this staircase kind of potential. Again, in that UN gauge theory, there's a large N and exactly the same N. You would expect that N would renormalize the Planck scale. All the same issues would arise. Yes. So if you imagine this thing, that's right. So let me at least go to a one limit where the n is obvious. If you push them very far apart, I agree. If you push them very far apart from each other, it looks like those n guys are getting more massive. If they're close to each other within the string scale of each other, there is n squared degrees of freedom there, right? And so, at least in the limit where they're close to each other, it's that, and that's the limit where it looks like indeed it's the, anyway, that's the limit where it is almost literally the monodromy of the UN gauge theory. And similarly, in the ideas with the large n units of flux, for example, as Matt talked about, where you nucleate, where you have a big magnetic flux, you nucleate particles and antiparticles that cancel it. There isn't an obviously n many fields, but the energy in that flux is large. It grows like n squared, and so if you try to hold everything fixed, the size of the dimensions fixed, everything fixed, and send n to infinity, then the energy contained in it would overwhelm whatever was stabilizing the radius. So this connection between n and m Planck, this is what I mean by the parametric connection between n and m Planck, is there in every example that I know of, but is definitely not numerical. Okay, so that was my attitude about it after after these investigations was that there's certainly nothing wrong in effective field theory. The issue, at least in many examples, is nothing going on in the deep UV, but having something mediating sub-gravitational strength forces. And there's a reason why that shouldn't be possible to arbitrarily tiny, to an arbitrarily tiny level related to why gravity doesn't like global symmetries, but it's not obvious that it should be a, it's not obvious that it should kill everything. Let me just say two more very quick things which arose after these thoughts, which support the idea that it's that nothing stops it numerically. One of them is that if we look at this idea that n particles should greatly renormalize the Planck scale, okay? So you think somehow I can't take a theory with a fixed UV scale and crank up the number of species because I get a correction to the Planck scale that goes like n times the UV scale. And then if you're an effective field theorist who's willing to fine-tune, you would say, well, I can always fine-tune to keep the Planck scale small. So yeah, I can do it by cranking up n however much I want. But here there really is something wrong. Here, it's very easy to have examples where you can prove that that's impossible. For instance, and this is actually a challenge to our loop quantum gravity friends. Okay? Let's say you have a theory in three-dimensional ADS with n U1 gauge fields in the bulk. And let's just say the three-dimensional ADS radius in units of the Planck scale for fun is 1,000, but I have 1,000,000 gauge fields in the bulk. Okay? Can you make this theory? If you can quantize this theory, there's something wrong with the method of quantization. Okay? Because there's, in fact, a sharp, sharp bound that M5 in LADS units must be larger than or equal to n. Okay? That follows from unitarity of the boundary CFT. The boundary CFT has these NU1s in it, and the rest of the CFT splits into these currents plus everything else. The central charge is n plus something positive from everything else. And so, since the central charge is the Planck scale in LADS units, M5L must be greater than or equal to n. You can't fine-tune. You can't do anything. Okay? This is just a sharp consequence of unitarity. There are things that are impossible. There really are. But look at how weak this bound is. Okay? It tells you that the number of species can be as big as what you can fit, not between the Planck scale and the UV cutoff, but between the Planck scale and the IR cutoff, which is, in this case, the ADS length. Okay? So there's plenty of room to be able to do it. And the second thing I'll mention before ending is that there's another example that convinced me that there's nothing wrong with the n, which didn't involve stabilization and all the intricate difficulties and it didn't involve the complexities of building an inflation model, but was a sort of a cousin problem that had similar features. Okay? So here's a cousin problem that has similar features to the Transplanckian issue of inflation. It's actually also motivated by having large decay constants. So if we can have f much larger than m Planck, then something that you can have, and those of you who remember this from the 80s, you can have Euclidean wormhole solutions with the axion nicely traversing through a Euclidean wormhole. And if f is much bigger than m Planck, the Euclidean wormhole is much fatter than is really big. Okay? Totally low curvature, totally trustworthy. Okay? So that also seems something funny. F much bigger than M Planck, you allow these funny wormholes. Now, string theorists tried to find these Euclidean wormholes in string theory. And there are lots of papers, but they couldn't find any for a long time. Okay? So that was another example of something that you couldn't do in string theory. Okay? You couldn't seem to find these Euclidean wormholes. Now, technically, what happens is that you have both dilatons and axions. So you have some fields, collectively phi. They can include both dilatons and axions. We have some kinetic term for all these fields on their moduli space. And technically, people couldn't find solutions. But it's interesting that if you actually ask the question, what does it take in order to find a wormhole solution? What it takes is the following. You have to find, in this moduli space, you have to find a geodesic whose length, so this is the distance now in this field space. You have to find a geodesic whose length in field space, measured in Planck units, if you're in d dimensions, is greater than or equal to d minus 1 over 2 times d minus 2. So this is a very close cousin of a Trans-Planckian issue. You want to make a Euclidean wormhole? So you want to have large R inflation? You need Trans-Planckian field traversals. Now, this is a cousin question, okay, of no phenomenological relevance. But you want to have a Euclidean wormhole? You need to have a Trans-Planckian, you need to have a Trans-Planckian excursion. And the excursion has got to be a specific size, okay, very specific, sharp number. OK, so now. Many people thought, well, Euclidean wormholes are very confusing. Coleman had this strange interpretation of them. They're sort of nasty things. They make physics even less predictive than even in a unique vacuum, physics wouldn't be a predictive if you took Coleman's interpretation. Maybe it's a good thing we don't get them in string theory. Okay? String theory solves a problem by not letting us have Euclidean wormholes. Okay? But it's not true. String theory, even maximally supersymmetric string theories, do have Euclidean wormholes. So this is something that actually a number of people found, but something I did in a paper with Joe Polchinski around 6 years ago. Now, how does it work? So now I'm not talking about with fluxes and any realistic compactifications. This is just a maximally supersymmetric theory compactified to six dimensions. Okay, compactified just 2B string theory compactified to six dimensions. You could fit it in the flat space region of ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. So let's say you just take the dilaton and the axion. The reason it doesn't work with the dilaton and the axion is that this number is a quarter for the dilaton and the axion. And you can easily verify a quarter never beats d minus 1 over 2 times d minus 2. OK. But when we took the theory, just the maximally supersymmetric theory now, compactified to six dimensions, we just found a particular direction in the moduli space that gave us four decoupled dilaton-acteon system. So that's the n. Okay? We got to enhance it by a factor of, in this case, the n was just 4. But 4 is enough so that 4 times a quarter beats the right-hand side in six dimensions. So there are Euclidean wormholes in string theory. And now this is nothing. This is just a very clean and simple setup. Okay? So once again, there's a Trans-Planckian traversal that would do something funny. But the theory lets you do it. You've got to work a little harder, but the theory lets you do it. OK, well, I had a number of other things I wanted to say, but I'm out of time. Let me just say one thing, though, which is that all of these mechanisms, all of them, you might have an attitude about them. Really, is it sort of complicated like that? That we have to have something winding around 50 times, or we have to have 100 scalar fields, or we have to have couplings that are 10 to the minus 3 smaller than gravity, and all these things. So it looks a little bit complicated. Well, I think from the point of view of the string landscape, this complication is totally reasonable, and I think also pales entirely compared to the complexity needed to get a small enough cosmological constant to begin with. Okay? And this is something I think maybe many people appreciate. But whether you love it or hate it, from this landscape perspective, inflation is an anthropic necessity. Okay? The reason is that if you go out of your way to make 10 of the 200 vacua enough to find one with a small enough cosmological constant, and then you populate it by eternal inflation, and you say, oh, I'm done, I'm walking away, now the universe will satisfy Weinberg, you look more carefully, you say, oh, shit, it doesn't. Because when I tunnel into the final bubble, it's a negative curvature universe. Curvature is dominating everything now. I still don't make structure. So I have to go one further step. The flatness problem is the little cousin of the cosmological constant problem, the very sub-leading cousin of the cosmological constant problem. So you have to do all this work to get rid of the CC. And then you're not even quite done yet. But then a little extra dipsy doodle at the end is completely reasonable from this perspective. Again, whether you love it or hate it, if you I think logically follow this or reasonably follow this line of thinking, it is totally fine. You could look at the whole thing and say I call bullshit on the whole thing, right? But I think it's hard to separate the two of them, at least in my mind, from each other. And perhaps, this might motivate thinking more about what goes in that question mark that I had in my table at the beginning. That perhaps there is some way of imagining driving inflation in a more in a non-geometric phase. Now, people have talked about this. It goes in the name of holographic inflation. Juan has emphasized this in some of his recent papers. So this is an interesting. I mean, it is an interesting thought. It's not ruled out. Of course, we don't know how to do any calculations with it at the level of. We don't have any detailed calculations, so we don't have any detailed proposals, just like in some ways with the Technicolor. Okay? But there's a clear goal to just try to come up with some phase of the theory that just gives us this background with a weak coupling. That's all it takes to get everything we've seen so far. But perhaps the origin of the complexity that we're seeing is that we're trying to take the physics that we're used to, even in string theory, which is adapted to understanding physics in flat space, or to calculate boundary correlators in ADS, all the ingredients that we know and love are there to ensure the consistency of that setup. Maybe things look complicated because we're trying to take those ingredients and make them do something which was not what they were born to do. Okay? Now, right. That's a point
I'm
that
I'm going to have to insert a cutoff there,
yes, sure,
to solve the Nima, yeah, misses his ride to the airport,
okay,
problem.
Anyway, so I'm done. That may be an unnecessarily mystical point of view, but I think it's something, again, given the experimental situation, is something very interesting worth investigating. Okay. Thank you.